I'd like to welcome you to the next installment of the Northampton Community Music Center podcast series. And today my guest is Matt Stammel, the proprietor of Stammel Stringed Instruments. And together we're going to talk about some of the mysteries of the violin, which has always been a very mysterious instrument to me. And I guess I'm going to start off by asking you kind of a silly question, which a lot of people don't realize the answer to, but what's the difference between a violin and a fiddle?
There's no difference between a violin and a fiddle. It's a fiddle is, at first, it's a slang word for the violin, but it's also a style of playing the violin. And it just became, you know, even Itzhak Perlman will call his violin a fiddle. So it's there is no difference.
Okay.
I'll say this, though. Sometimes people who play fiddle music have their violin set up a little differently, like with the bridge a little bit flatter so they can do double and triple stops more easily. Uh-huh. It's the same exact instrument, just used to play different kinds of music. And the slang word for a violin is fiddle.
Okay. Do they use different strings?
Sometimes, but sometimes not. That's, you know, fiddle players, people who are playing fiddle music, sometimes will use steel strings, but steel strings are becoming less and less common now that all the composite strings have come into play.
Uh-huh. So what are composite strings?
So strings used to be made from gut, and then string technology changed where they started to wind the strings with metal. And then there was a material called Perlon that came along, which simulates gut. So it has similar properties to gut, but it doesn't stretch nearly as much. So it's more impervious to the climate. And some strings, like the brand names that people are familiar with, are, say, Dominant, that really took over the market at one point. That's a Perlon core. And then, for instance, the G string is wound with silver, the D and the A with aluminum, and the E can be either a straight steel E or an aluminum wound E. But now there's many, many kinds of synthetic core strings, Perlon and other kinds. Long answer to a short question.
Yeah. Why would they use a different metal on the G string than on the others?
Well, they found that the combination... that the string responds best in a certain tonal range with different materials used for the winding. For the G string, it's been found that silver provides the best response in that tonal range. That's for violin. Cello is a different thing. Uh-huh. So there's, you know, there's chrome wound, silver wound, other metals that are much more expensive that are wound, used for windings.
So what separates one violin from another? What the cheapest Chinese ones that are more like instrument-shaped objects up to more student or intermediate or professional violins?
Okay, well, this is a big question. The violin... You know, the one thing that drew me to the violin, that I was started as a guitar maker, and the thing that drew me to the violin is how individual they are. And even instruments that are made in a workshop, each one is a little bit different. I suppose that could be true of guitars, but guitars
it certainly
are,
is.
Yes, it is. It's true of guitars, it's true of mandolins, but it's especially true of violins, because the tradition with violins is handmade. And so what separates them? The wood, the grade of wood, how old the wood is, how seasoned, the amount of flaming on the wood. And then
tell our audience what flaming is.
Flaming, the grain, when you look at a violin, a lot of times it looks like tiger flames. It looks like there's a lot of depth to the wood, because what you're seeing is the grain rising and falling. And so it's end grain and face grain, and that's what gives it that look of it's called tiger maple, flamed maple, curly maple, and it's the grain that's rising and falling. Most, it looks like the grain is going horizontal across the back, but actually the grain is going the long way across, down the back from top to bottom. And what you're seeing when you see those flames is the rise and fall of the grain through the piece.
Sorry for the interruption. So you can go back.
So, you know, we're talking about what separates the cheap Chinese violins from better violins. And it all starts with the wood. For instance, I did go to China and I went to the Eastman workshop, which is a big workshop outside of Beijing. And they have a football field worth of wood that's stored outside under roofs, under like in little sheds. And so the wood is being seasoned there and it's all segregated. Okay, we're going to use this wood for our low end instrument. We're going to use this wood for a little better grade of instrument. We're going to use this wood for a more master grade of instrument. And so from the beginning, the wood is kind of apportioned to different levels of instruments. And it's apportioned by the grain structure, the amount of flaming, where the wood came from, and then it's moved from there, it's moved inside into a building where it dries further. And so violin wood, it's air dried. It's not dried in a kiln. Same is true for guitar wood, mandolin wood. And it all starts from that. And then that wood is apportioned to different models of instruments that these workshops will then sell in different price ranges. So, I mean, that's one way it starts. And then from there, for instance, the better grade of instrument might have an oil varnish, whereas the more factory made, the more mass produced instruments might have a spirit varnish. And the difference is the spirit varnish dries very quickly, where the oil varnish dries very slowly. Historically, the best instruments, the old Italian instruments, were all made with oil varnish. I don't know how far you want me to go with this, but...
So why is the finish so important to the sound of the violin?
Well, so the violin is naturally, can be sort of a squeaky instrument. It's really very, the high pitched, it can be a little annoying if it's not a sweet sounding instrument. And so the softer finish, which is a varnish, tends to dampen the higher frequencies. Whereas, say, with a guitar, those are often finished with lacquer, which is a very hard finish, and that will brighten up the sound. So the goal with a violin finish is to protect the wood, but also to sweeten the sound and dampen some of the higher frequencies, and it gives it more roundness. So violins tend to have a softer finish, and guitars tend to have a harder finish.
It's always amazed me that an instrument as small as a violin can be so loud that it, you know, you can have a violin and a piano, which is enormous and has these, you know, has all this percussion that can make it really loud. And yet the violin is just as loud as the piano is. And a violin is, you know, you get a violin and a guitar together, the violin can be much louder than the guitar. And can you say something about what, they're so much smaller and they have so much less wood in them,
yes,
to vibrate?
That wasn't always the case, because the violin, it evolved from the Baroque form. So you hear, you know, you hear about Baroque orchestras and Baroque instruments. Those instruments, those violins were made to be played with gut strings, and they were kind of soft. They didn't project as much. They weren't as loud, but then it evolved. And as concert halls got a little larger, the technology, the string technology changed. And so, and also other changes were made, like the neck angle of the way the neck attached to the body changed. And then it all started in the late 1500s when the Amati family from Cremona, Italy, really gave the violin the shape that we know it today, and And then Stradivari came along, and he is purported to have studied with Niccolo Amati. My teacher, my restoration teacher, used to say that Strad installed the power steering. So what he did is he made a few changes to the violin that really gave it the power that we know today. And those changes were, he lowered the arch of the top, especially from the Amati style, and he lengthened the instrument as well, slightly. Everything, all these changes that happened to the violin are like, people would look at them and not see any difference because it's in millimeters. But Stradivari really gave the instrument more power, and primarily by lowering the arch and lengthening the body. The other thing I'd say is the violin has a sound post, and that differentiates it from almost every other stringed instrument. I mean, the violin, viola, cello, the bass, they all have this sound post. And what that does is it makes the back and the sides like an amplifier. It couples the top to the back and sides. And so all of the vibrations and the way the violin works happens from the bridge through the top to the sound post. And the sound post relays these messages to the back and the sides. And that's what gives the violin all this power that you're talking about.
And so every violin that's been made since that 16th century has been kind of copied Stradivarius designs.
Yes, not just Stradivarius, other makers too from that time period. The makers of Cremona, Italy, and that area, northern Italy, it's a town that's between Venice and Milan, essentially. And for whatever reason, that became the crucible of violin making. Right. Also, along with Amati and Stradivari was Guarneri, the Guarneri family, and other families as well, who became quite prominent from that town.
So I assume that ever since then, people have been trying to improve on the design of the violin, or some people must, because you know, people are tinkerers by nature. So I'm sure people have been trying to improve, but they haven't been too successful, I guess.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's still most contemporary makers copy primarily Stradivari and Guarneri. People do design their own, but basically nothing's changed since the late 1500s, early 1600s with the violin.
Now, people are starting to make them out of composite materials now. What do you think about those?
I have very limited experience with them. I know, that there is some instruments being made with carbon fiber. I think that they probably have a place, if people are playing outside, et cetera. But to me, I mean, the reason I'm in this was because of my love of wood and woodworking. Uh-huh. And I haven't gotten involved with those instruments, more so with the bows. I do get involved with carbon fiber bows. I think that's been a pretty good thing. It's a way for people to get a very good bow for a much lower price, because the bow is a whole separate but corollary part to this.
Right. I was actually about to ask you about the bows and what's the difference between them also.
Oh, boy, that's a big topic. Bows are made from various woods. The most famous and most widely used wood is called Pernambuco. And Pernambuco grows in one part of Brazil. In fact, there's a province called Pernambuco. It's a coastal rainforest wood. And that wood was originally used for its color properties. It was exported a lot to France, where it was used as a dye wood for the clothing industry. It has like a reddish, brown, yellow colors to the wood. And they used to extract those colors from the wood and use it in clothing. What happened was bow makers discovered that this wood had the exact properties they needed. Especially when the bow switched from its Baroque form, which was a convex bend to the bow, to the concave bow. And that was started primarily by François Xavier Tort in France. And the Pernambuco wood, and that wood, it can bend it bends well, and also can be made to the correct weight. And so you can thickness the wood and come out with a comfortable thickness bow with the correct bend, which is called the camber. And it holds its shape very well. It had all of the properties that bow makers were looking for. And that wood became the standard. But the lower, less expensive bows were made from other kinds of wood like ipé. They never were quite as good. They don't hold the camber as well. The camber is really important. It's a little like cross-country skis or like, say, an archery, the bow. You know, it has to be, it's bent to that shape. And that's what gives the bow its spring, like if we're playing off the string kinds of bowing, staccato. So the Pernambuco became the wood of choice. It's still the wood of choice, although it's gotten a little overused. There was so much Pernambuco that they used to use it for fence posts and just all kinds of building material. They would burn it in Brazil.
Is that getting hard to get now with all the troubles of Brazilian?
Yes. The Brazilian government, like with Brazilian rosewood for guitars, they put restrictions on it. And now any Pernambuco that's harvested there has to be certified by the government as legally harvested and certified wood. And so it's still available, but it's more tightly controlled. There have been efforts at reforestation of Pernambuco in recent years. A friend of mine named Marco Raposo was one of the people who started this Pernambuco Conservation Initiative. He has a bow making company in southern Brazil, and he's been developing this whole program of reforestation, and many of the other bow making companies have gotten on board because it's good for them. It's good for everybody.
Right. There's, so why is the bow so important to the sound of the violin?
Yeah, the bow really colors the sound. I mean, every bow is a little bit different. It has a little bit different weight, different balance. And if you, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, if you have a violin and you play it with one bow, the same player, and then if they pick up a different bow, the sound is colored differently. There's different response. Nobody can actually describe exactly what's going on here. It's trial and error with bows because the violin bows have a certain weight that is considered the medium weight. For instance, with violins, it's 60 grams. For viola, it's 70 grams. For cello, it's 80 grams. But of course, they can weigh anywhere. A violin bow can weigh as little as 52 or 53 grams and as much as 64, 65 grams. But interestingly, the light bow can feel heavy and the heavy bow can feel light. And it all has to do with where the weight is and where how the bow is balanced. Bow making is one tricky business. It's as tricky as making an instrument. Because it's so precise. I mean, right. how the bow is cambered and shaped and balanced, and you know, they have a balance point, and people, you know, there's a thing called the Lukey meter to test the resonance of each piece of wood, and its density. Some of the old great French bows, when you pick them up, it feels so different than a modern bow, a bow made today. It's something about the density of the wood. And the Hills from England, they also had access to some of this great wood. It's a little like sitting down at the wheel of a great car that you just, when you drive it, you know you're driving something right. Special. Same with a great bow like that.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. If somebody brings a violin into your shop and wants you to buy it from them, I could look at it and I wouldn't be able to answer these questions, but you could look at it and say how old the violin and which country it comes from and whether it's from a well-known maker. And so what do you look for when, what are the clues that you look for when you're looking at a violin that tell you?
Well, that's That's interesting. It's also a big topic. I mean, I've spent the last 35 years kind of studying this stuff. I really didn't know a whole lot about it myself. And I just, since I'm just focused on violin, viola, cello, I really have had the opportunity to sharpen my eye for this. Someone was here 15 minutes ago and they opened their case, and I knew right away it was a Mittenwald violin, Mittenwald being a town in Germany. How do I know? I think you just have to get old in this business to know anything. I still think, you know, I'm learning all the time. I'm, it's from seeing instruments from different countries and different schools over and over again, and seeing the work of different makers over and over again, so that you can recognize their work when you see it. It's not unlike paintings. It's its own little niche, its own little world. Some people can tell you, you know, where a painting was from, or what era it's from, what school, is it the Flemish school? And it's from just from seeing, and I've attended lots of auctions all around the world. I've gone to visit makers and shops all over the world and studied this and made it my business to try to know what I'm looking at. For me to tell you how I can pinpoint, I can tell you that 15 minutes ago someone was here and they took out a Mittenwald violin. How did I know? It had the shape, it had the color of the varnish, and then there were some telltale signs. As I looked at it closer, it had what's called a schnitt, which is a way that the Mittenwald makers from the 1700s and 1800s, they used this little mark at the very bottom of the instrument as their center line. And so that's how they lined up the whole everything, back, sides, top, was by this mark. And this had this mark. How do I know this? It's just from, you know, I've just made it my business to know how different places learn to make instruments. So when I look at an instrument, I'll often just take it in as a whole to start. I usually look at the back and the sides first. I try not to look at the label, which often means nothing anyway, because labels get changed and labels get covered over or taken out. And so I try to look for the instrument to give me the clues of what I'm looking at. And different places use different kinds of wood, especially different kinds of varnish, different ways of making the edges, the purfling. The scroll is often like a signature of a maker. All the little variations in the scroll, how the windings are done, how the chin is done. These are all little details, and I'm still learning all the time. But what I have learned is that when it comes to identifying old instruments, you're getting opinions. And certain people's opinions are more valuable on the market than other people's opinions. For instance, Charles Baer from London, the Baer workshop, famous workshop, it's been around for a long time. The opinion of Baer is probably still the most important opinion in the world. Baer may or may not be right about that opinion, but that's what you're getting. And it's not unlike an opinion about a painting. Do you have a Renoir? Do you have a Gauguin? Well, who said it's that? That's what will, on the market, that's what's going to make a difference, is whose opinion you have and who certified it. So that's something with old instruments that becomes really crucial to the marketability of any instrument and the value. So I do a lot of valuing of instruments, and that's a big part of it.
Speaking of value, violins are much smaller than cellos, but they're worth more than cellos. And cellos are much smaller than basses, but they're worth more than basses. Is there any explanation for that?
Well, that's not always true. It's not always the case that the cello, or the violin is worth more than the cello.
Well, when I bought my good bass, you know, I went to a store in New York, and the most expensive one they had there was like $65,000, which is way below what the best violins and cellos sell for.
Very true. That's true. Basses are its own, are really its own category. And maybe that has something to do with supply and demand. There are lots of bass players, but not basses are so big and they're so prone to injury that maybe people don't spend as much on the bass because of how prone to injury they can be. And also a lot of them have had lots of repairs over the years. I don't know exactly why basses are less, but you're right that basses tend to be less than cellos and violins and violas for that matter. But if you have a great cello, a Stradivari cello, and you have a violin, a modern Italian violin, that's, you know, the cello is going to be worth more than the violin.
Right, but the Stradivari violin is going to be worth more than a Stradivari cello.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The Strad violin is going to be worth more than the Strad cello, isn't it? Usually?
That depends on its condition and provenance, who played it before, who might have owned it. Yes, it's not always so clear. I mean, the factors that go into it are who says it's authentic, what's the condition, who owned it before, and what's its history. Those things will contribute to the value.
So I wanted to ask another question that, comparing violins and guitars, and with guitars, you have, you know, there's a major commercial industry that makes guitars, and there are certain brand names that people can rely on when they look for guitars. That really doesn't exist in the same way for violins. I mean, there's no, Eastman is a name that goes on violins, but it's not, and you mentioned that, but it's, there really isn't like a commercial violin industry like there's a commercial guitar industry, particularly in the United States. I don't think anybody, is there any commercial violin making in the United States that's on a big scale?
No. There's no commercial violin making in the United States on a big scale. Most of that is now in China. It used to be in Germany in these workshops, like I was saying about Mittenwald or Mark Nikirkin, or in France in Mirecourt. Those were towns that were devoted to the violin. But even there, it was workshops. No machines. It's people specialized in making scrolls or in carving the back or carving the top, but it was pretty small production compared to guitars. So yes, there's no commercial violin making in the United States that I know of. I know someone who's recently attempted it, and I don't think they've gotten too far. He's put a lot of effort into machinery, into duplicating machines and that kind of thing. But he found that it's very, very difficult to do. There are a couple of workshops, for instance, the William Harris Lee workshop out of Chicago. They've been successful at making instruments that they sell to different shops around the country. Handmade instruments by different makers in their workshop. That's about as close as we get here in this country.
We're going to run out of time fairly soon, but let me ask you just one more thing before we go. And that is, if you're somebody who's learning to play the violin or maybe has been playing for a little while, but you need a better instrument, what's your advice about what to look for when you're going to look for a violin?
Well, I think for beginners, I think renting is the best way to go. Rent for a while. But even with rental, I mean, what to look for, playability, that the instrument should speak easily, be comfortable to play. And there's a lot of little things that go into that, neck angle, scoop of the fingerboard, that it's set up well and that the strings are good strings. I think that beginning players almost need better instruments than accomplished players, because the violin family instruments, they're very hard. They're hard to learn. It takes time. That's why kids start young. And I think that the beginners need something that will encourage them, that's easy to play. It's hard to verbalize what to look for, because sometimes the shiniest, brightest things tend to be the worst instruments. I think it's good if it has real ebony pegs or real ebony fingerboard and not a dyed maple pegs and fingerboard, and that the bridge is of good quality, the neck angle is good. It's the whole combination. Ultimately, find somebody you trust and take their advice, I think, with the violin. I think a lot of it is trusting your source. I would definitely not advise people to buy anything online just because the price is low. Almost always, people who get instruments on Amazon or, you know, online, they end up being shocked that to get it to play well is going to cost as much or more as what they paid for the instrument. And oftentimes, it's not even worth putting that money into it. So in my motto for the last 35 years is cheap is expensive when it comes to the violin world.
You mentioned pegs. I'm curious what you think about the planetary geared pegs, like the perfection pegs. Mm-hmm. The first time I tried tuning a violin with one of them, it just knocked me over. I said, why doesn't every violin player use these? But they don't.
Yeah. I think they're very good, a big advance. We've been putting them especially more into cellos lately. However, and, you know, the good thing about the newer ones, there used to be the Caspari pegs in the 70s and 80s. That's what we had. And in order to install them, you had to ream the holes and glue in the peg. It ruined the instruments. It destroyed those instruments. To repair that damage when those pegs wear out, which inevitably they do, it cost hundreds of dollars or more. Now you don't have to destroy the instrument to use a planetary peg. And I think for certain instruments, they're great, but I would never put them in fine old French, Italian, right, English instruments. Never, okay, because they're too precious and right, you don't want to mess with that.
Well, speaking of that, I have to ask you, have you ever come in to contact in your shop with a real Stradivarius or Amati or
Guarneri? Oh, yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Many times. I've had a Stradivari here for sale.
Really? Wow.
I did not sell it, but I had it for some time. And yes, I've had Amati and Guarneri. And, you know, I have a network of other dealers that I trust and work with. And depending on who has a client for what, we share these instruments. I don't want to have that kind of inventory here unless I have serious people looking for it. But when I do get those instruments. Uh-huh. And it's a big responsibility. Insurance cost goes way up.
Yep, I'm sure. Yeah. It must be pretty exciting though.
It's very exciting because you're holding some history and, right, you know, I mean, these are the biblical makers, right, really for this, right, craft. And it's very, very exciting.
Okay, well, we're about out of time. This has been really interesting to learn more about the instrument, and I hope our listeners have had a little good education too. So thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. I hope I didn't bore people too much.
Well, no, it's fascinating. So before we go, I'll tell you the joke about what the difference between a violin and the fiddle is.
Okay.
Is the idiot on the end of the stick.
I like that.
Okay. I learned that joke recently. I thought it was pretty good. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.